Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 255, MindSight with Daniel Siegel, MD. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I think, you know, if we do this together, then the sky's the limit on what we can achieve. And I know the world's in a very, very painful place for lots and lots of people all around the planet. But people can now, with all this new scientific understanding and this framework for understanding what well-being is, we can be empowered to actually one person, one relationship, one community at a time, really empower ourselves to promote integration and promote compassion and kindness.
We can promote compassion, integration, and kindness. So says my guest, Dr. Dan Siegel, discussing his latest book, MindSight, and the organization he has founded, the MindSight Institute. Daniel J. Siegel, MD, received his medical degree from Harvard University and completed his postgraduate medical education at UCLA with training in pediatrics and child, adolescent, and adult psychiatry. He served as a National Institute of Mental Health Research Fellow at UCLA, studying family interactions with an emphasis on how attachment experiences influence emotions, behavior, autobiographical memory, and narrative. Dr. Siegel is currently a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, where he is also on the faculty of the Center for Culture, Brain, and Development, and the co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center at UCLA. An award-winning educator, he is a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and recipient of several other honorary fellowships. Dr. Siegel is also the executive director of the MindSight Institute, an educational organization that focuses on how the development of MindSight in individuals, families, and communities can be enhanced by examining the interface of human relationships and basic biological processes. His psychotherapy practice includes children, adolescents, adults, couples, and families. Dr. Siegel has published extensively for the professional audience. He is the co-editor of a handbook of psychiatry and the author of numerous articles, chapters, and internationally acclaimed text, The Developing Mind Toward a Neurobiology of Interpersonal Experience. This book introduces the ideas of interpersonal neurobiology and has been of interest to and utilized by a number of organizations, including the U.S. Department of Justice, the Vatican's Pontifical Council for the Family, Microsoft and Google, early intervention programs, and a range of clinical and research departments worldwide. He has been invited to lecture for the King of Thailand, Pope John Paul II, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Dr. Siegel serves as the founding editor for the Norton Professional Series on Interpersonal Neurobiology, which also includes more than 20 textbooks. His book with Mary Hartzell, Parenting from the Inside Out, How a Deeper Self-Understanding Can Help You Raise Children Who Thrive, expresses the application of this newly emerging view of the mind, the brain, and human relationships. His professional book, The Mindful Brain, Reflections and Attunement in the Cultivation of Well-Being, explores the nature of mindful awareness as a process that harnesses the social circuitry of the brain as it promotes mental, physical, and relational health. His book, MindSight, The New Science of Personal Transformation, offers the general reader an in-depth exploration of the power of the mind to integrate the brain and promote well-being. His latest professional text, The Mindful Therapist, explores the application of these ideas for the clinician's own development of mind, sight, and neural integration. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dan Siegel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be here.
I am really happy to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss your work. As I was reading your latest book, which is called Mindsight, I appreciated reading about some of your personal struggle as a young medical student at Harvard. You actually dropped out of medical school for a time because of what you felt was missing in the curriculum at that time. Tell us a bit about what led to that disaffection and what you did during those intervening years before returning to Harvard Med.
Well, you know, I had been a biochemistry major in college and also was very interested in other things like, you know, people, basically. And
yeah.
I had worked on a suicide prevention service and, you know, was on the dance team and things like that. And so I thought medical school would be a great opportunity to blend, you know, the real passion I had about people with my background in science. And the science was very useful, of course, for learning the technical aspects of medicine. But when I was a young student, my first year and then the second year, unfortunately, I encountered perhaps what was not the majority of professors, but the particular ones I met and who supervised me had this really unfortunate trait, which is that they treated people as if they were kind of bags of chemicals. So rather than having a center of a subjective mental life, a core aspect of the essence of their humanity, instead they were treated just like they were a bunch of enzymes in need of, you know, surgery or medical prescriptions or whatever. And I was very young when I started school, and I think my youth and also my idealism just made it so I tried my best to do what I thought what you're supposed to do, which was to learn from your teachers. But the more and more I learned from these particular people who didn't see the mind, a word I end up coining in my head called mindsight. They seem to lack this thing called mindsight, to see the mind, that I got very depressed and disillusioned with the whole experience, and ultimately came to the dean of students after one particularly horrendous interaction with a supervisor during a final physical examination review. It's a long story, but the bottom line, it was very, very painful to see the way he treated the patient, you know, not in a very kind or empathic way. So I went to the dean of students and I just basically said, you know, I can't go on anymore. I'm dropping out. And while in my mind I was dropping out, she insisted that I just take a leave of absence, which I thought would be a leave forever, you know.
Yeah.
And I ended up spending a little under a year, actually. I loved dancing in college, so I thought about becoming a dancer and a choreographer. I pursued that for a while, and then when I decided that wasn't going to be my calling for all sorts of reasons, I traveled across Canada to become a salmon fisherman. And that didn't exactly work out for all sorts of reasons, too, and came back and worked in Los Angeles as kind of the sound technician for a film crew that was filming the performing arts at Royce Hall at UCLA. And during that time, it's actually a year ago today, I actually had surgery during that time, and John Lennon was unfortunately assassinated 30 years ago. And I woke up out of the anesthesia and heard this news report that Lennon was killed, and I couldn't believe it. And I just, in my mind, it was like, why in the world would a person kill John Lennon? And it kind of opened my mind to other things that had been cooking during that time off of travel and dance and stuff, of like, what is the mind? You know, what was in the mind of his murderer that would get him to take such a incredibly benign and contributing member of our society and kill him intentionally? And so that really opened up my own awareness of the idea that you could try to figure out what's going on in people's minds and try to help those minds get better. And through a series of different things, I ultimately decided to go back to school because it was actually faster for me to become a psychiatrist than to become a psychologist, because I was halfway done with medical school. So I went back to Harvard, and armed with, you know, this year off and the conviction I had that the mind was real, I could then use Mindsight in my own inner world to this is back now in 1980-81, you know, to say, look, some people don't see the mind, and they are my anti-role models. And I, if they're my professors, I have to not be like that.
Yeah.
And then I saw that, you know, when patients, you know, my medical patients, when you saw their minds, when you could, you know, really relate to their feelings and ask them what they were thinking, what they remembered, what had meaning for them, these stories that emerged and the feelings that accompany them seemed to help people get better. And ironically, you know, I finished medical school, went into pediatrics, went into psychiatry, went into child psychiatry, went into research psychiatry, became a scientist studying narratives and emotion regulation, and ultimately I started teaching about that kind of stuff and coming up with new ideas about it. But years later, like about, I guess it was, let me do the math, it was 20 years, maybe 25 years actually, somewhere around there, let me do the math. It must have been 25 years after the day I decided to drop out of school, in the very room that I decided, a place called the Ether Dome. I was back there giving a lecture, invited to give a keynote address, the opening keynote address to Harvard, on the importance of stories and emotion in the development of health.
What a triumph.
It was unbelievable. My son was there. It was just, it was incredible.
Yeah, and to come full circle.
Anyway, that's a full circle. Exactly.
To come full circle like that must have been so gratifying. And I certainly was disaffected with much of my graduate school experience. But, it, you know, for both of us, it gave us the credentials that we needed to move on and develop our own ideas. Now, MindSight is a new term that you introduced into our therapeutic vocabulary. What do you mean by MindSight?
Well, originally the word MindSight back in 1980 and 81 was just a little kind of private term I made up saying, you know, how do you see the mind? And then as I went through my training, you know, in medical school, it helped me just, I think, remain sane, basically. And then when I became a psychiatry trainee, I saw that there's something very special about not only how we as clinicians see the inner subjective world of another person, the mental life of another person, the see inside. But when we teach them, our clients, our patients, how to develop the skill of seeing the mind, perceiving the mental world, they can then start to work with that inner life in a very different way. And so MindSight then became more than just, you know, insight into yourself or empathy for another person. Those are very, very, very important. But it became also, how do you shape your own internal world or help another person shape their internal world toward health? So now the way MindSight is it's a term that means how you perceive the inner world and that move that world towards something I call integration, which we can talk about. But integration is basically a process where you link different elements to one another. And in the world I work in, we consider integration as health. So MindSight allows you to not only see the inner world of yourself or others, it helps move that world in yourself or others toward well-being because it promotes integration.
And maybe the integration is the answer to this next question, because MindSight sounds a lot like mindfulness. Is there a difference?
Yes.
Is there a difference?
Yes. The two words that people always ask me about, and it's a very important question, is the two words are, one is mindfulness, and the other is something called mentalization. And I'll start with the mentalization part. Mentalization is a term that Peter Fonagy and Mary Target and Howard Miriam Steele, these are researchers in London, and also Arietta Slade and John Greenenberger, these are fabulous researchers. In the 90s and in the last decade, the 2000s, you know, they studied basically the way parents see the inner mental life of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And when parents reflect on that inner life of themselves, in something called reflective function, or their child, they're basically using mentalization, that they're seeing things in mental terms. So MindSight, of course, embraces those fantastic studies of mentalization and seeing the mind is at the core of something called secure attachment. Really, really good for developing resilience and thriving, really.
Right.
So MindSight overlaps with that, but it's not the same in a way I'll explore in a moment. Mindfulness, the next word. Mindfulness, of course, is something that's been around for thousands of years. It's been in the East and the West. It's also used in contemporary practices and religion and contemplative traditions. So in Buddhism, for example, in Hinduism, in the Islamic faith, in Judaism, in Christianity, in the Lakota tradition, in all sorts of traditions, there's an effort to encourage members of that culture to focus on the present moment, to not be swept up by judgments and expectations, and to then use this ability to focus your mind, your attention, on the present moment sensory experience so that you're not suffering. So it allows you to distinguish, for example, between self-created suffering and inevitable pain in life. So that suffering might be seen as coming from saying, oh, I shouldn't have hit my knee. I shouldn't have hit my knee. What a clump, what a clumsy guy I am. You know, I'm so clumsy. Look how I've done that to myself. I'm so bad. I'm so bad. All that negative talk would create suffering when instead I've just bumped my knee.
Right.
So mindfulness, just as a little example there, as you pay attention to the present moment, as Jon Kabat-Zinn beautifully has described it, in a purposeful way, without being swept up by judgments, and other people describe that it's imbued with a feeling of kindness, an attitude of compassion toward the self and other. And that's mindfulness. Now, mindsight, this term I made up, you know, before I even know there was a term called mindfulness, it embraces all those fantastic practices of mindfulness, but it's not the same. Now, how is it not the same? Because mindsight is the way we monitor energy and information flow in our relationships. So like what's sharing now between me and you, Dave, the way we're sharing with people who might listen to this taping, that's a relationship, the sharing of energy and information flow. Then there's the embodied part. There's the mechanism of the energy and information flow that extends from your toes to your nose. It's basically a neural mechanism, and you can learn to become sensitive so you perceive or monitor this flow. And then basically whether the flow is happening in your body, the embodied brain, I call it, or in your relationships, the sharing is relationships, the mechanism is the embodied part, you can then use the focus on energy and information flow to move that flow toward integration. And this is something that's not talked about in the mindfulness world. It's not talked about in mentalization. So in this way, mindsight really, if you took a triangle and said there's relationships in the brain, and there's an emergent property that we call the mind, so that's a third point, relationships, brain, and mind, on this triangle. And basically, what we say is that mindset's the ability to perceive energy and information flow in your subjective mental life, in the sharing of relationships, in the mechanism of the body, and then move that flow toward integration. And so that's how mindset is distinct from mindfulness, which it embraces, and mentalization, which it embraces, but it takes it into the realm of health and integration in body and in relationships.
Good. Let me catch our audience up to something that's kind of been implied in what you've said, because the term mindsight begs the question of the mind. And I was interested to read that you called together a conference of peers at Harvard, or maybe it wasn't at Harvard, and that you experienced some frustration looking for a definition of mind because nobody had a good one, and you ended up coming with your own, which you've kind of alluded to here, and I'll quote, "The human mind is a rational and embodied process that regulates the flow of energy and information."
Right, and Dave, I would just edit that a little bit. I think you meant to say relational.
Oh, did I? Yes, I did.
You said, I think I heard you say rational.
I mean,
it could be rational, too.
I'm glad you caught that. You're right. Yeah. I did mean to say relational. And one of the things I especially appreciated that you also just alluded to is your emphasis on the whole body, that the mind is not just in the brain that's in the skull, but that the brain is in some sense distributed throughout the body.
Exactly. Well, so here's what happened. The thing that I brought together was actually a think tank of 40 scientists, and it was at UCLA back in 1992, the beginning of the decade of the brain. And our task was to just ask the question, what is the connection between the brain and the mind? Mm-hmm. And everyone could, you know, these were anthropologists, sociologists, linguistics people. These were people from neuroscience, from one neurosurgeon who was in the room, psychology. All sorts of groups were there. So 40 people from over a dozen different disciplines of science. We could all agree on what the word brain meant. No one knows exactly how the brain works, but we knew it was composed of basic cells distributed throughout the whole body, but many of them in a spider web-like set of connections in the skull itself. And we were learning lots of new, exciting things back then in the beginning of the decade of the brain, because technology had allowed us to look beneath the previously opaque skull and see what the functioning of this stuff was, looking at the skull part of the brain. I use the word brain to mean the embodied nervous system. Brain is a lot easier to say. So here we were now ready to turn to the mind, and these scientists could not find any common ground on what to say about what that word meant. And this was really, really frustrating, and the group was going to basically implode and disappear. So I took myself for a walk as the person who invited everyone into the group, and the next week the group got together. I offered a definition, the one you said, basically that the mind, one part of the mind, not the whole mind, because of course the mind is consciousness and subjective experience and beauty and love and poetry and everything is a part of mental life like that. But one core aspect of the mind can be defined as the way energy and information flow is regulated. So we say it's a relational and an embodied process that regulates the flow of energy and information. Now, when you say it like that, you need to understand that at that moment, saying it to this group, every single one of the 40 scientists said, yes, this is a place we can begin our discussion. This fits with everything I do. An anthropologist would say, you know, yes, I study the way energy and information flow is shared in relationships across generations. That's what culture is. So that's fine with me. And then a neuroscientist said, yeah, I put a person in a scanner. I have energy flow, let's say, from a picture they're seeing. And the moment it has meaning, information, I see what parts of the brain are activated. I'm looking for energy and information flow in the brain itself, and that's fine with me. So the group, with 100% consensus, went on to meet for 4.5 years.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, 4.5 years. Yeah. And, you know, the exciting thing was we could go deeply with that working definition. Now, just so we're on the same page about this, what this means is that the process says that the mind, this core aspect of the mind, is a verb, it's not a noun.
Mm-hmm.
And from a scientific point of view, we use the concept of an emergent property. And, you know, the emergent property is something you see by elements of a system interacting with each other, give rise to a process called an emergent property. And that's what I'm suggesting the mind is, and the group found that very useful. Now, here's the strange thing that happened. As of today, you know, this is now December 2010, I've asked 97,990, I'm counting, because I'm going to stop when I get to 100,000. 97,990, I'm at now, psychotherapists from around the world, from every discipline of psychotherapy you can imagine, you know, social work, nursing, psychology, psychiatry, all of us in mental health. The number's always the same. How many of you have ever had even one lecture, besides one I gave, you know, that defined the mind? 2 to 5% say yes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is almost 100,000, not quite. It's always the same. Way over 95% say, I've never been given even one lecture that defined the mind. So what people have told me, and I don't know if this is true, but they say, look, you're proposing a revolution in the field of mental health. And I say, I don't think it's a revolution. I just think it's a natural evolution, that we've had a field of mental health that didn't define the mental. And now it's natural to just define it together, a working definition. Because when you say it's relational and embodied, it honors the power of relationships. And, of course, that makes people nervous, because then they don't own their mind. And, of course, anyone in a relationship knows you don't. It's dependent on everybody else in the relationship. And then the embodied part means every psychotherapist needs to know about the nervous system, needs to know about brain science and biology, you know, which of course makes them nervous. But, you know, listen, that's what it means to be a professional. We need to know about relationships and the embodied brain also. And then when you say it's a regulatory process, here's the exciting thing that happens. Regulation means you have to monitor something, like when you're watching where you're driving a car, and modify that thing. And so the thing is energy and information flow, energy being, you know, the capacity to do stuff is how a physicist defines it. Information is a swirl of energy that has symbolic meaning, like these words we're using with each other. And so when you realize that you have to monitor and modify energy information flow in your relationships and in your body, and then we put in the thing, which we can talk about next if you want, Dave, you know, that we're talking about integration, because we don't just say, hey, you know, regulate yourself. We're actually saying we can define health, mental health, or any kind of health probably, but let's just stick with mental health. Mental health is integration. And integration is the linkage to differentiate parts. And amazingly, when you're not integrated, you go to chaos or rigidity. And when I first kind of came across that and looked for the science of that, it blew my mind, because I went to a mathematics book because I could find no science that said why chaos and rigidity would be the patterns I was seeing in my patients in psychotherapy. So I found this book that said basically mathematics of complex systems is that when they're not linking differentiated parts and maximizing complexity, which is like a choir singing in harmony, when they're not going in this harmonious flow that's flexible and adaptive, they go to either chaos or rigidity. And I opened up the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and I opened it up to any page, and every single symptom of every syndrome in that book, which has no conceptual framework, that book, but now every single symptom of every syndrome was an example of chaos, rigidity, or both. And I thought, oh my God, this is a book designed not to have a framework, but now we can finally have a framework that not just says that impaired integration leads to any of the psychiatric syndromes, and now we know it's being supported by new data coming out by Marcus Raichel and Marty Teicher and all sorts of people to show that developmental trauma or schizophrenia or autism or bipolar disorder show evidence of impaired neural integration, you know, where the parts of the brain that link differentiated parts aren't working well together. You can also show that you can promote integration through psychotherapy. And it works, and people go from chaos or rigidity into more harmonious states of being, which we call well-being. So the framework has embedded in it a definition of health, a pathway to understand how integration is health, impairments lead to chaos or rigidity, and then a plan for what you can do about it. So that's kind of where we're at in this field. I work this mindset kind of approach.
Yeah, that's great. And I can tell you're chomping at the bit to talk more about integration. And you spell out eight functional areas of integration. And I want to give you a chance to do that, but not too deeply, because I also want to make sure that we have time to touch on some of the cases that you present.
Sure. Whatever you would like, Dave, we can.
Yeah, take us through the highlights of the integration.
Well, you know, what happened to me back in the 90s when all this was kind of emerging in my own explorations was, first of all, an importance to stay really close to science. So everything I'm saying has a scientific foundation that comes from many, many different disciplines of science, so you won't see it written anywhere in one place. But what the process is looking for the common principles across separate disciplines, and that's something Wilson calls consilience. And he hadn't written his book, but he wrote his book in 1998, and this was happening way before that. But, you know, it turns out I was using a consilient approach to try to draw on different sciences. So the first thing to say is that these ideas are built from science, and then they're applied in everyday life and parenting and in psychotherapy and in schools, actually, in educational settings, so that there is a practical benefit to these scientific and, you know, conceptual ideas. So that's the first thing to say. And then, you know, people would ask me, as I was teaching a lot, you know, back in the 90s and then now in this century, they'd say, well, you know, give us a practical guide. And I would say, look, this approach, which I call interpersonal neurobiology, this interpersonal neurobiology approach is about health, but it isn't a form of therapy. It informs therapy, sure, but it's really a way of bringing all the different disciplines of science and now contemplative practice, religion, art, music, dance, you know, all these different ways of exploring truth of being, the truth of being human and being alive, they're all welcome into this this conversation. So when they said, you know, get practical, then I had to really try to formulate what I was doing in my private therapy suite. And when I started teaching students the more organized approach to these eight domains you're talking about, I started teaching students, and then they started applying them, for example, in integrating consciousness. So you say, well, what's that? Well, that's, you know, finding a way to differentiate awareness from that which you're aware of and then linking those. Well, what other kind of integration? Well, there's something called bilateral integration. Looking at the difference between the left hemisphere and the right, and there's a beautiful book called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist that explores these differences between left and right. And what we've been doing is kind of exploring how do you integrate the two, honor the differences, promote the differences, honor them, but then cultivate connection. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, the integration is not the same as blending, or it's not like a smoothie, it's more like a fruit salad, you know. It's you maintain your individual identities so that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Right.
So that's the key of integration. So there's bilateral integration, then there's, you know, there's vertical integration that is honoring these deep processes in the body itself, the muscles, the intestines, the heart, the brainstem, the subcortical areas, also like the limbic area, and how you bring those up into, you know, cortically mediated forms of awareness. So that's vertical integration. And then there's memory integration, where you literally see how different elements of synaptic shadows from past experience are embedded in forms of memory called implicit memory. You can literally pull them together, take the differentiated elements and link them together in something called explicit memory. And that you can see how trauma is in large part an impediment to memory integration. And if you have an integrated memory, then the next form of integration, narrative integration, we are narrative creatures. And, you know, you need to have a way where you find meaning by connecting the past, present, and future. Now, this connection of past, present, and future is really the fundamental core of narrative. And narrative integration allows you to become not just a passive historian of what's happened to you, but actually the active constructor of your own life story. It's like you become your own novelist.
Right.
That's narrative integration. Then there's state integration, which is the brain is capable of these different states. Like, you know, one state in me wants to be in solitude because I love just, you know, getting into the present moment and going inward. Another part of me loves to be social. Well, with one body, how do I take these two states and give them both what they need? So that's just a simple example of, you know, state integration is honoring differences, promoting linkages, not becoming the same. I don't say, oh, I got to choose one or the other. No, I hold on to the opposites within awareness, and I intentionally find harmony by bringing them together. That's state
integration. I have to say that sounds very Jungian in a way.
Does it? Well, you know what I love? I love when...
Yeah, holding of the opposites is an essential Jungian concept. Go ahead.
Well, it's so beautiful when I hear that because, you know, what we're looking for is consilience. The sages and wise elders, all of whose shoulders we stand upon, you know, if this works, then this framework should meet the criteria for Jungian, you know, analysis, psychoanalysis from a Freudian point of view, cognitive behavior work, EMDR work, narrative therapy, family therapy, group therapy. It should fit with contemplative practice. It turns out it does.
Wow.
And so, yeah, it's so, I can't tell you how exciting it is because I'm often asked to give addresses to each of these groups, including the religious groups. And what people find is it's consilient with their approach. So what I say is that interpersonal neurobiology, this mindset approach, is really a place for all of us to come together and collaborate to try to bring more kindness into the world. And, you know, the next kind of integration, interpersonal integration, is all about that. You know, how do you honor differences and promote linkages, which basically, that's kindness. Integration is kindness.
Yeah, I have really been sensing this coming together, that some kind of coming together has been happening. And the way that you're articulating, the way we could all get under the same tent,
Yes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's brilliant. And it really does build on a lot of threads of thought and approaches that have been more and more articulating ideas like mindfulness, the various functions of the brain with our emerging better understanding of the brain and so on, and the role of memory and all of that. So it's beautiful. One of the things I love about your book, too, is that you ground many of these ideas in case histories. And early in the book, you relate a case history of Barbara, who suffered from headaches. Perhaps you could take us through that, because it effectively sets up many of the theoretical points that you make.
Sure. Well, Barbara suffered from a car accident, is what she suffered from. And unfortunately, you know, she had a terrible damage, so sad, to the part of her brain just behind the forehead in the arc of a steering wheel, because she unfortunately didn't wear her safety belt. And so what happened in taking care of her family was the family was falling apart after this brain damage, and her neurosurgeon lent me her scans, and I took the scans to the library. And so I looked up the parts of the brain that had been damaged and pursued a scientific review of what did we know at that time. This is a long, long time ago, you know, from the science of the brain that could help us understand what areas were damaged and what the science would tell us about what those areas were responsible for. So ultimately, you know, a list of 9 functions that emerged from this area behind the forehead came out, and I could help the family, the children and the husband, understand why Barbara was not Barbara anymore, even though she looked similar because she had plastic surgery and had, you know, brain surgery removed, all sorts of things. But, you know, she got better from a physical point of view, but not from a mental point of view. And this area of the brain is one of the most integrative regions. That is, it's part of the cortex, but it links the cortex to the areas below it, the limbic area, the brainstem, the body proper. It even makes maps of the firing of other nervous systems called, you know, empathy. And these are mindsight maps of the self. I call them me maps, or mindsight maps of someone else. That's a you map. And even a mindsight map that makes an internal representation of a sense of we. And I call those mindset we maps. You know, Barbara didn't have any of those maps anymore. And the whole family collapsed. And these maps we make in our cortical regions, these prefrontal areas, are necessary for us to have social and emotional intelligence. They're necessary for other people to feel felt by us. And all these ways that Barbara used to be, unfortunately, sadly, she could no longer create, because those areas of her brain, the integrative areas, couldn't pull all that stuff together. So, you know, the family was able to go through a grieving process when they could understand the truth. And that insight about the importance of knowing about integration in the brain and its role in creating well-being in our families really started me on a journey to really honor relationships. And I was being trained as a relationship scientist, and also look at narrative, because we make meaning out of these experiences. And so much of what the kids and husband had to do is to make meaning out of this loss. So I wanted to put together some kind of view that tied relationships, narrative, psychotherapy, and the brain and integration all into one kind of perspective. And so Barbara, while her situation was so painful, you know, the family did recover in a very deep and powerful way and could do the healing necessary. And the lessons learned there have been profoundly important for understanding the importance for integration in our relational and mental and neural health.
Great. Thanks for taking us through that. We now know that there is this reciprocal interaction between the brain and our thoughts, that the brain shapes our thoughts, but our thoughts can also shape our brain. So what do you see, you know, and you talk about this under the heading of neuroplasticity. What do you see as the deeper implications of this neuroplasticity?
Oh, it's huge, Dave. I mean, here's the power of it. You know, it's the simplistic model that was kind of running around, I think, a while ago, was that, you know, the brain runs the show. Like they'll say, the mind is just the activity of the brain, or a side effect of brain activity or whatever. But what we now know is that the brain is constantly changing. And your mind, your mental life, the process that regulates the flow of energy and information in your relationships and your body, including the stuff up in your skull. The way you focus energy and information flow, which is basically how you pay attention, drives your pattern of thinking. It can alter how you feel, and it specifically activates the firing of certain circuits of neurons. And when you make your neurons fire by the energy of your mind and the focus of that flow, you can actually get the brain to change not only its firing in the moment, but you can rewire it so that it changes its synaptic connections. You can grow new neurons. You can alter myelin sheath that's laid down connecting neurons in a circuit so that the effective flow is 3,000 times more potent when you lay down myelin. And now we're learning, so not only synapse formation, neuron formation from new neurons, from stem cells in the brain, myelin formation, those three are now really excitingly, we know that, but now the even more cutting edge area is epigenesis. You can actually change the regulation of gene expression in these molecules called epigenetic molecules. And the preliminary data is coming in. It was just, you know, published a week ago that, for example, if you use mindfulness meditation, which is using the focus of your attention in a very specific way to pay attention to present moment experience and letting go of judgments, when you're taught how to do that, you can actually reduce the destruction of a part of the chromosome called telomeres. And when the telomere destruction is reduced, you actually, conceptually, theoretically, you're extending your lifespan. So basically, we have these ends of the chromosomes, and when you use them all up, your body is ready to die. So if you can slow down that telomere turnover by increasing something called telomerase, which now, the study now came out, that mindfulness meditation decreases telomere turnover, that is, it increases telomerase. Now, the beauty of that is, just to say what you're saying, is that we now know the focus of your mind, that's all mindfulness meditation is focusing your mind in a particular way. It's very powerful. But that's basically using the mind to change not only the connections of the brain from other studies, but even changing epigenetic control of gene expression. So we're at this incredibly exciting time to empower ourselves to develop our mind with mental training to promote well-being in body and relationships and mental life in ways we could only dream of before. And now we have the mechanisms that are just being illuminated to support these important steps toward health.
And now another factor is mirror neurons, which play a key role in the interpersonal aspect of your interpersonal neurobiology. Take us a bit through the role of mirror neurons in empathy and emotional contagion.
Sure. Well, you know, like anything in science, you can say up and a bunch of people say, no, it's down. So we need to just start by saying that mirror neurons are extremely exciting. I think they're an incredible discovery by some researchers in Italy, Rizzolatti and Galesi and others. They were discovered and proven to be in human beings by Marco Iacoboni and Yitzhak Fried here at UCLA in a neurosurgery, open brain surgery thing they were doing. There are a lot of contributors to this field, but you need to know, some scientists don't believe they exist.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, but I've experienced, since I'm trained as a scientist, literally I can say up and someone else say, no, it's down. And so you just need to know, it doesn't really say much to say there are some scientists who don't believe it, but I've been in meetings where I'll start talking about mirror neurons and people say they don't exist. So just keep in mind that while we can get excited about them, there are a group of scientists who think they don't exist, just like some scientists don't think relationships impact development.
Okay.
They think it's all genes. So, you know, just because a scientist has their belief doesn't mean their belief is true. But I just want to have our listeners honor that there are different points of view. We always have to really, really respect that. I'm sorry, go ahead. So if you believe in mirror neurons, it's qualifying, which I happen to believe in, because I've read the research and I really think it's fantastic. Basically, what this is, and there's a long history to it, but I'll just cut to the chase, that there are neurons that we have in human beings, as well as other primates. And I'm convinced my dogs have them too, but that's a whole other story. That what they do basically is they're constantly scanning the movements of other beings, living creatures, and trying to detect predictable patterns. When these mirror neurons detect a predictable pattern, they have a process called the sensory implication of motor action. And what that means is that, Dave, if I see you moving your hand toward a glass of water and lifting the glass toward your mouth, I'm going to start predicting that you're going to drink water. Now, that action, my mirror neurons work with an area called the superior temporal cortex to create a map of your intentional state. So the first step that these mirror neurons do is they're looking for predictable sequences. The next thing they do is they make a neural map of another being's intention, which is a mental state. So now I've mapped out your intention, and then I can do two things with that mapping of your intention. The first thing I do is I drive that information down into my subcortical areas. These are all cortical regions, superior temporal cortex, mirror neurons are in the parietal area and the anterior area as well as lobe as well as other areas besides these frontal and the parietal regions. And I drive it down into my limbic area and probably downward to my brainstem and make my body resonate with you. So I might start feeling thirsty, for example. So we call that internal simulation. And the second thing I'm doing, too, is I'm going to get ready for behavioral imitation. That is, my hand may try to find a glass, or it may even happen automatically, and I find a glass, and I start drinking when you're drinking. Just like when someone yawns and you yawn, or someone crosses their leg and you cross your leg. These are behavioral imitations, and there's also then internal simulation. So the mirror neurons allow for behavioral imitation, and they, through the insula, they go downward to the subcortical areas, rising back up through the insula to the prefrontal areas, especially the right anterior insula. A twig of it goes over the right anterior cingulate. I just call this whole set of prefrontal areas the resonant circuit. So you can resonate with another person. I can resonate with you, and I'll feel thirsty. Or if you're in pain, I could feel your pain. Or if you're joyful, I could feel joyful. So this is the modern conceptualization of the neurobiology of empathy and compassion, that we move from internal simulation then in these middle prefrontal areas that that patient Barbara unfortunately had severely damaged. These middle prefrontal areas not only map out our internal subcortical state in something called interoception, but then you take interoception in these middle prefrontal areas and you make a map of what's going on in your own mental life, like, oh, I'm feeling sad. And then you take the next step over in an adjacent area of the middle prefrontal region, and you say, I wonder if Dave is sad. And so we draw on interoceptive ability, the ability to perceive inward, and we then imagine what we ourselves are feeling with insight, and then we project really that insight into ourselves onto what we imagine is going on in someone else, which we can call empathy. And that's kind of the pathway. And this is how mirror neurons fit into the whole exciting discoveries about the nature of our relationships with each other.
Yeah, great, great. I have a friend who and colleague who knew I was going to be speaking with you and who was bugging me to make sure that I got you talking a bit about intuition. Toward the end of the book, you describe an incident in which you were working in Puerto Rico and you prescribed medication for a toddler, Pablo, and somehow, days later, you had a nagging intuition that you had made a potentially fatal mistake of having prescribed too high a dose. Would intuition be the right word there?
You know, people use the word intuition just like they use the word empathy and the word compassion in so many different ways. So I'm sure some people, like I said earlier, everyone has a complaint about everything, would say, ah, that's not intuition. Intuition is more about creativity. I draw on the scientific literature of intuition being non-rational reasoning. And in our heart and in our intestines, we literally have an extensive network of neurons that operate in what's called parallel distributed processing that don't act on the laws of rationality, but can know things that our rational thinking does not know. So that's what I use as intuition. Those neural net processes around the intestine and the heart make their way up through an area called lamina 1 in the spinal cord, along with other interoceptive data from the body, the interior of the body. they move their way up to the brainstem, and a twig goes over to the hypothalamus to control endocrine function. But then other branches go a little bit to the right anterior cingulate and to the right anterior first dorsal insula, then the anterior insula, where you have a representation of the bodily state. Those interoceptive intuitions give you access to the wisdom of the body. Luckily, it wasn't a couple of days, but it was the same day as the prescription happened. The thing that took so long was that, you know, it was in Puerto Rico and he had no phone. And while everybody assured me, oh, I'm sure you did the right thing, I just didn't feel right. And so I went on this long, long journey to try to find him. And I had, you know, was a medical student. I had made my first big medical error, which, you know, if let's say you're supposed to take 2 milligrams of something and for a day and give it 3 times a day, I gave him 2 milligrams 3 times a day. And I never wrote it down, you know. So luckily I went and checked the bottle and it was wrong. And he would have probably become deaf because the kind of antibiotic he was on is toxic to the hair cells in the ear. So anyway, it's just, you know, one of the things as I learned as a young, you know, medical student and ultimately, you know, as a physician that, you know, you can't reason your way through everything. You have to really trust your gut and your heart because these are deep sources of intuitive knowledge. So in that sense, yes, I think it's a very appropriate use of the word intuition. You know, other people might use intuition for something else, and that's fine. It's all, you know, whatever word you use, you should just be really clear you're defining it, just like the word mind, you know.
Yeah, well, I regularly have experiences, not life and death ones, but where I've made a mistake and I'm not aware of it at the time. And then either during the night or hours later or the next day, it will suddenly pop into my mind. Oh my God, I forgot to do, you know, this or that. And it's kind of amazing that there's some place in there that's tracking that even when I'm consciously have missed it. Do you believe that intuition can be trained?
Yes, I absolutely do. I believe that the skills we can learn, I mean, I call them mindsight skills. Other people might call them mental skills or reflective skills or mindfulness skills. The words don't matter. But the idea that you're increasing your ability to track energy and information flow in your body, literally examining the interior state of the body. And, you know, there's a practice I talk about in the Mindsight book and the Mindful Therapist book that, you know, at my website, you know, drdansiegel.com, you can actually hear this streamed for free. You can just kind of stream it and listen to it, is the Wheel of Awareness. And the Wheel of Awareness is basically the first step of integrating consciousness. And, you know, what people tell me, because now a lot of people have been doing it, is it trains intuition. And I think the studies of, you know, outcome measures for mindfulness practice that I believe ultimately integrate the brain are really developing your right anterior insula area. I mean, that's what all the studies are now showing. And I believe this is the neural gateway for intuition.
Well, not long ago, I interviewed Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain, and and he has this catchphrase to the effect that our brain is like Velcro for negative thoughts and like Teflon for positive thoughts. In other words, that evolution has programmed us to be somewhat cautious, fearful, and doubting for our survival as a species. So when people start looking within, they might find a lot of thoughts, images, attitudes that are fear-driven. So the question is, how can we learn to distinguish useful intuitions from not-so-useful fears?
Sure. I think that's a fantastic question and a very useful way of approaching it. You know, when you develop this hub of your mind and the Wheel of Awareness and the elements of fear become clear on the rim and the internal state of receptivity of the hub becomes just experientially clear, then it becomes much, much easier to differentiate, you know, automatic negative thoughts and fear-driven, you know, images from intuitions that are helpful. And so part of why the Wheel of Awareness, I think, has been embraced by so many people now in different settings is because it just does that automatically. You can't think yourself into a better way of distinguishing those. You have to experience it from the inside out. And it just, you know, when people do the wheel, they really, they get it and they can feel the difference. And it's just, I think because it comes from integration. You know, in the book, The Mindful Therapist, the clinician is walked through exactly that question. And I talk about a different issue of intuition, how you would know. And it just becomes clear when you look at the neurobiology of truth, you know, that there are untruthful, fear-driven thought processes, and then there's truth-based, more integrated ways of knowing. And, you know, doing the wheel practice allows you to distinguish between those two. Things can otherwise absolutely overlap and be very confusing.
I notice you've created something called the MindSight Institute. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the MindSight Institute is basically the home for interpersonal neurobiology. I mean, I founded a Norton series, and we have now almost 24 books out that are, support this view in interpersonal neurobiology. The MindSight Institute is the home for this work, and, you know, we have online courses, so if people want to get more training, they just come to the website, drdansiegel.com, so Dr. Dan Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.com. And when they go there, they'll find, you know, all the different online courses. We have a 3-year program that you can jump on to any time. We have, you know, courses that are happening here in Southern California. We have an interpersonal neurobiology meeting that happens. Now we're starting it in March. We've got all sorts of times when I go out for the MindSight Institute to teach in different countries and different states of, you know, the United States. So the MindSight Institute is basically the educational center for interpersonal neurobiology that, you know, basically our mission is to take science, make it useful for educators, for parents, for psychotherapists, for organizations, to ultimately try to help facilitate the world becoming kinder and more compassionate. That's our goal.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a worthy goal. Well, we should probably wrap it up here. I've skipped over a bunch of questions, but I don't want to keep you beyond the time that we kind of committed to. And I just love how integrative your work is. Is there any sort of final thought that you would like to leave our listeners with?
No, I think, you know, if we do this together, then the sky's the limit on what we can achieve. And I know the world's in a very, very painful place for lots and lots of people all around the planet. But people can now, with all this new scientific understanding and this framework for understanding what well-being is, we can be empowered to actually one person, one relationship, one community at a time, really empower ourselves to promote integration and promote compassion and kindness. This is something we can do. We can help affect global change issues, which is an area I work in. We can work with people in communities that are really struggling to really bring this kind of resilience from the inside out. And doing this together, I think we can do incredible things. So I want to welcome everyone into the MindSight community, and I look forward to meeting people in person.
Dr. Dan Siegel, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Dave, thank you. It's been really a pleasure. This is really great. Great interview. Thank you.
I feel quite confident that you enjoyed this interview with UCLA psychiatry professor, researcher, and author, Dr. Dan Siegel. Wow, what an exciting, productive, and creative career he's having. I feel so privileged to have had this opportunity to speak with Dr. Siegel, as well as the other high-caliber mindfulness and brain researchers that I've been able to feature here recently. If you want more of Dr. Dan Siegel, I can definitely recommend his book, MindSight. And if you'd like to get a look at him, a search on YouTube will turn up a talk he gave to the folks at Google. His book, The Mindful Therapist, should be of particular interest to those therapists and therapists in training in our audience who've been asking for more information on how to incorporate mindfulness into their practice.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Shrink Wrap Radio, Shrink Wrap.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Happy New Year, everyone. As I record this, it's a sunny yet crispy cold morning here in Northern California. What with Christmas and New Year's and lots of family holiday celebrations and birthdays, it feels like I've been away from my podcasting for a long time. Time to get my head back in the game for another year of interesting and hopefully surprising guests. As usual, I've got another interview for you over on wisecounselpodcast.com. This time my guest is Sandra Sarin, PhD, discussing her work on premarital counseling. If you or someone you know is thinking of getting married, you might want to check this one out. Let me remind you that if you need CE units, we have two APA-accredited courses where you can earn your units by listening to these podcasts. One course is on the wisdom of the dream, and the other is on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. And while you're on our site, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. Now, each of these links can save you money and connect you to great products and services. As I've observed before, just about all of us use inkjet printers and therefore need to buy ink cartridges for those inkjet printers. I don't know why more of you aren't using my discount code. Instead of paying $30 for an inkjet cartridge, you'll end up paying significantly less than $10 when you buy them in sets at 4inkjets.com. So please go to our site and follow the links from there. Now, we have a new transcript available on the site. It's Shrink Wrap Radio number 213 on the highly sensitive person with Dr. Ted Zeff. And I want to publicly thank listener Erica Steves, who stepped up to help in this way. I think these written transcripts add considerable value to the whole effort. If you don't have time to listen to an interview, or you want to refresh your memory, you can very quickly scan through the written transcript. Speaking of thanks, I'd like to acknowledge our December donors who helped to take the old year out in style. Their one-time and ongoing donations helped to keep the flame burning brightly. In fact, I'd like to acknowledge these December 2010 donors, and I hope none will be offended by this show of public gratitude. We received a record total of $510 this past month as a result of ongoing and one-time contributions from Deborah Swain, Joseph Pentany, Michelle Wheeler, Joan Kelly, Christine McKinnon, Trevor Ehrman, Srinivasa Rao, Peter Velez, Andy Hunt, Simon Huggins, Leon Sang, Maureen Holcomb, Shanofsky Photography and Design, Kathleen Vortman, Gary Graham, Valerie Pratt, and Kathy Samworth. So a big thanks to all you donors. And to the rest of you, please consider adding your name to this honor roll of Shrink Wrap Radio supporters.
Hi, this is psychologist and sleep expert and author Dr. Ruben Nyman, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Ruben Nyman, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from Swedish student Alexander, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Van Nuys. I'm a Swedish psychologist student that wanted to broaden my knowledge and found your podcast 4 months ago and has soon listened to each and every one of them." That's pretty incredible. He goes on to say, "I just donated a few bucks. I'm sorry I couldn't afford more. I'm a student on very limited means with 3 kids. Oh boy, you do have your hands full. So try to see the donation in that perspective rather than the actual sum if you can. I definitely can. I'm very thankful for your shows. In Sweden, we have specific psychologist programs with a whole class of students that aspire to license to practice clinical psychology.
even if you can't decide to go into other psych-oriented directions as well. Many of your shows have helped me to get an edge over my classmates. Well, being in my 30s also helps when most of my classmates are in their early 20s, but still, you're part of my education. Thanks. I have one tiny little thing I want to write to you about. I know we live in different cultures and all that, but still, I get the feeling you think everyone should be heterosexual, that heterosexuality is the norm, normal, and healthy choice. When you refer to family, it is always a mom and a dad, you assume, and I feel like in me and my family, it isn't really welcome to listen to your shows. You seem very open to different ways of reasoning, and maybe it's just my overly sensitive ears that hears that you think that a family needs to have a man and a woman in it. I hope so, because I really think that a family can come in many forms and still be healthy. But mostly, I'm very happy for your shows, and I will keep listening to all of them. With kind regards, Alexander. Well, Alexander, thanks so much for that reminder. First of all, thank you for your donation. I really do appreciate it, particularly given your situation, as you describe it. And it's a good reminder to hear that there are other kinds of family structures out there. You know, I'm aware of that, but sometimes I forget about it. The traditional nuclear family in this country is perhaps in the minority already. Certainly, it's in great decline. And something I haven't mentioned on the show, but one of my sons is actually gay, and we have a very close relationship. And so, I don't think I have any prejudice against other kinds of family relationships. I celebrate families in all the forms that they come in, and I thank you for that reminder nonetheless. Because, hey, I'm an old guy. It's easy to slip into old language and old thinking. Next, we hear from Renata, who offered to be a transcriber and who also wrote, "Hi, I'm a fine arts major at Concordia University in Montreal, and I usually listen to your podcast while I'm working on my assignments in the studios at school. I guess this allows me to get a full brain workout since both right and left brain hemispheres are going simultaneously. I enjoy your show, and I especially appreciate the thoughtful manner in which you conduct your interviews. Keep up the good work, Renata." Renata, thanks for volunteering to be a transcriber and for that lovely feedback. And I'm happy to be helping to stimulate both hemispheres of your brain. Next, we hear from Debbie, who responded to my thanks for her donation. And she wrote, "My pleasure. I've been getting a great deal of enjoyment from both interview series, and I definitely hope you keep producing them. I'm a bit of a latecomer to the world of podcasting, and I marvel again and again at the wealth of information and entertainment that is available. Some major broadcasting studios, of course, but some equally good programs from broadcasting amateurs like you. What a gift. Thank you, Debbie." Yes, we do have to go head-to-head with the public broadcasting system and Australian broadcasting system and, you know, other commercial entities that have much better funding and a lot fancier equipment. Hey, but we're holding up our end of the stick here, I think. The next one is from my co-author, lead author, really, on the book we wrote several years ago about the Zodiac serial killer, Michael Kelleher. And he writes, "Hi, David, I've so enjoyed these rainy days." He lives up in Washington now, Washington State. And he says, "I've so enjoyed these rainy, snowy days that give me all the time I need to catch up on your podcasts. They're as good as it gets, my friend. Without getting into too much detail, my own individuation work has led me to uncover what I call the myth of the special child. I can find no definitive information about this mythos, but I know from personal experience that is certainly real. In a nutshell, the myth is predictably instilled very early and reorients the individual via a strong myth of, quote, specialness, and all that implies, good, bad, inconsequential. It's a very much a life changer, as you can imagine, serving both positive and not so positive beliefs, behaviors, and outcomes. Do you know of such a myth? Can you steer me in some direction? Hope you're doing well, my friend. We talk about you often, Mike." So I was so pleased to learn that Mike is a listener Mike and his wife, Cindy. And that myth of the special child certainly resonates with me. I suggested the book by Alice Miller, The Drama of the Gifted Child, which it turns out Michael was already familiar with. And I've sent an inquiry off to a couple of my Jungian interviewees, but if anybody out there knows of a resource, a book, or person that Michael might want to know about, please let me know. And here's one last one from an Anglican sister in the UK who writes, "Hello, thanks very much for your Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap radio podcast series. I'm a recently qualified, quotes, integrative psychosynthesis psychotherapist, and have found them extremely helpful in stretching my thinking and raising my awareness of developments in the field. I wonder whether you may have heard of Peggy Pace and her lifespan integration therapy. I suspect that there may be links with the memory reconsolidation, which you've discussed in some of your podcasts. I would be very interested to hear an interview with her if you were to do one. I haven't listened to every episode yet. Maybe I will find something on psychosynthesis as well. With all good wishes and many thanks for this great service, Susan." And I wrote back to Susan, let her know that I had some training in psychosynthesis myself years ago through the Esalen Institute. I have not been following psychosynthesis recently, and I've added Peggy Pace to my very long list of suggested guests. We might eventually get to her. So we're running a bit long here. I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember to send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave me voicemails on Skype. Or how about a voice message on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Dan Siegel for sharing his exciting work on MindSight. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Ruben Nyman, author and longtime worker in the area of sleep and dreams. He has his own unique take on these topics, and I think you'll appreciate learning about it. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.